this is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Gleb Sapursky. Gleb, it's great having you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me on, Robert.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pilliter.
Hi, guys. It's nice talking to you.
Gleb, you're a college professor, and you're an advocate on behalf of rationalism. Can you tell us about your background?
Sure. Happy to tell you about it. So I'm a professor in the history of behavioral science here at Ohio State University, or the Ohio State University, I'm contractually obliged to pronounce it. So, yes, I study the intersection of decision-making and emotional and social intelligence in politics and other areas of life. I also run a nonprofit called Intentional Insights, which popularizes the science in decision-making and emotional and social intelligence and so on for a broad audience. And I run, as part of that nonprofit, I coordinate the Rational Politics Project, which aims to promote rational thinking in politics and fight our current post-truth politics present to get to what we hope would be a pro-truth politics future.
Can you talk about the origins of rationalism? It's an ideology that emerged out of the Enlightenment, decisions based on methodology and science.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So this idea of rationalism, it did emerge out of the Enlightenment, and it's applying our reason and evidence and an experimental approach to making decisions, looking at what is the actual evidence, looking, experiencing things through our senses. So not thinking about abstract beings or gods or so on, but looking, being very empirical, looking at what's there and using that evidence of our sensory experiences to make decisions and to inform our activities.
How did you originally get interested in rationalism? You talk about how your personal connection to it.
Sure. So I was always interested, since I was a teenager, in how people made decisions, how people thought, and why they decided what they did, and how their decisions, especially how their decisions went wrong. I saw so many people making bad decisions around me, and their decisions had really poor consequences. And so I was really, and as someone who really is passionate about people having a good life, I'm a utilitarian, so I want our society to be the best possible society. I was really interested in how to help people make the best decisions possible. And that, to me, that led me to study decision making as a science. And so I discovered that people often wrongly perceive rationalism as being very cold, very simply logical-oriented and not considering emotions, whereas in reality, rationality involves a lot of considering of our emotions and our intuitions and looking, because emotions and intuitions are the vast and most major component in our decision-making. And so it's a combination of looking at our emotions, seeing where they're leading us, but then noticing when they lead us astray in specific ways, because they do. There are a number of systematic errors that cause us to make poor decisions. And we can talk about those on this show if you want, Robert and Pilliter. But yes, so looking at our emotions, seeing where they lead us astray and correcting them so that we have more emotion that orient us toward the truth and making reasonable decisions that get us to our goals.
So rationalism, you're making the case that everyone should make decisions, either political decisions or decisions in life, based on rationalism and logic. The thing is, I think there are different like personality types. Some people are extremely logical. Some people are emotional in a sense that they may have issues with anger, issues with resentment, or some people are maybe overly compassionate and altruistic in a sense that it's very emotionally driven. how do you kind of reconcile that different people have these different personality types? Obviously, not everyone is going to be a rationalist just based on their personal psychology.
Sure. So being a rationalist doesn't mean not having strong emotions and not being kind of, you know, having anger and so on. Rationality is about making decisions that are oriented toward your goals. So you might be someone who has an angry personality, but that might not match your goals to be angry in certain situations. For example, if you are being criticized by your boss for doing your job improperly, an angry person might want to punch the boss in the face, you know, and I can certainly understand where that feeling is coming from, but it might not match the person's goals of actually having a job. That it might be better off for that person to incorporate the criticism and be able to perform their job better in the future. And the same thing for a person who is, you know, let's say someone in the Star Trek series of Spock, who's very cold. That's not a very rational perspective either, because the person, you know, being very cold doesn't enable you to understand where other people are coming from and not being empathetic. So empathy is a really important part of decision making. It's seeing where other people are coming from, what they care about, and then making those decisions, one's own decisions, based on what other people's concerns are. So altruism, there's nothing absolutely wrong with altruism. I consider myself a pretty altruistic person. I wouldn't be spending my time, you know, promoting these ideas if, you know, I could just be getting paid for money for doing other stuff if I was selfish, if I was purely self-oriented. I care about other people. I'm very utilitarian. So that comes from a very emotional perspective. I am a very emotional person, and I'm very comfortable with that. But I orient toward figuring out what my goals are, my long-term goals, and then channeling my emotions in such a way that they lead me toward those goals. Because our emotions are very important, and no matter how emotional anyone is, no matter anyone's personality, we can always look ahead and see what our goals are, and we can, if we need to, shift our personality or our emotions to be more aligned with our goals. Because our goals, our values, is who we are, not our current personality. People change their personality throughout their lives, and that's fine. So just looking toward your goals and making decisions based on your goals is what's crucial. The same thing goes for politics. So you raise the question of politics. A lot of people make decisions in politics based on their gut instincts, based on their intuitions. But what we talk about in the Rational Politics Project is differentiating gut feelings from one's goals. You know, one might feel that, that Trump, let's say, really deserved to win the popular vote. That has little to do with the fact that there's no discovery of evidence of massive voter fraud, as Trump claims. So desire for Trump to win the popular vote doesn't mean that he actually won the popular vote. So no matter how fervent your belief that he should win the popular vote, it doesn't mean that that's so. And it's important to recognize this truth and differentiate our desired beliefs from the truth of the ground, on the reality, the stark truth, in other words.
As far as people who are successful in politics, has there been a successful politician who has gotten elected and gotten into power on a rationalist-based platform? It seems to be that most people who are successful politically are good at manipulating people's emotions.
Sure. Manipulating emotions is not necessarily a bad thing at all. As we talked about, it's important to have emotions and to be empathetic toward people, to understand where they're coming from. I'll give you an example of Obama. I think he's a very rationalist politician. And he had a platform of hope. So he was speaking to people's hopes, but he was backing that up with evidence. So he was not only, he was orienting toward both the heart and the mind. That is a very rationalist thing to do, to orient toward the heart and the mind. We know that people, voters, tend to resonate most with the heart, so it's not a bad thing at all to speak to the heart, to speak to people's emotions, to speak to where they are, but then provide evidence, provide mind to back that up and to not lie. Obama has a very rationalist perspective on decision making. He deliberated a lot on his decisions. He listened to a lot of people. You know, a lot of people accused him of not going with his gut nearly, you know, as much as they would have liked, not making snap decisions. I think it's great. We want more politicians like that. We want more politicians who don't go with their gut, aren't reactant, who look to the long term and, you know, make wise decisions as a result of listening to both sides and having a systematic and thorough decision-making process. One that considers emotions and one that considers long-term goals and values and makes a decision that involves all of them. As a matter of fact, Barack Obama signed an executive order getting the federal administration to incorporate behavioral science insights, so kind of the rationality essentially, into its processes. So that's, I think it's very admirable that he did that. So I would say that he, and there are a number of other similar politicians who have a thorough, well-structured decision-making process that is oriented toward long-term goals and values, are quite aligned with rationality.
I think, speaking about Donald Trump, I actually voted for Donald Trump through, I think, originally I was interested in Donald Trump in high school through emotional reasons. I remember when Mitt Romney was running, and then you hear this guy, Donald Trump, running, and I was thinking to myself, wow, this is funny. This is like Arnold Schwarzenegger running for president. And at the time, you know, I knew he was not going to run for president. And I think his first fiasco was when he said he was talking to someone in Las Vegas and he goes, "We're going to tax China." And then he goes, "Listen, you motherfuckers, we're going to tax you by tenors." And then people in the crowd got crazy, right? What kind of president would say fuck in a sentence? And so he was basically bashed. And I remember I was still in high school and I was thinking, oh, there's no way he could be president. But it gives you some hope that anybody can be president. And then all of a sudden, now that I graduated college, it turns out last year Donald Trump is seriously running for president. And then all of a sudden I got this emotional high again saying, wow, he's going to really try and be serious this time. And then the whole Donald Trump fever began and now he's our president.
Pillar, what was it about Donald Trump that really motivated you to vote for him?
Well, actually, I think at first, I voted for Gary Johnson, the Libertarian Party, and that was like my first vote. And that vote was based upon, you know, heart reasoning or some logic and rationale. I wish there would be more of a Libertarian candidate running because I think that is rational and I like what he has to say. Now, given the chance that you've had this, you know, you've now had figures like Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, and then, you know, they're more politically based. And so what has happened is when Donald Trump, you know, saying only Rosie O'Donnell as he hate women really shook up the establishment. And I can agree that I'm certainly a part of a generation which assumes, you know, Donald Trump is the quote-unquote anti-establishment figure, along with Bernie Sanders. And that really plays an emotional part, and that's, I think, he got a lot of votes through that. Unlike Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton, who represented the politically correct establishment, it's going to either have a sheep mentality and say, okay, it's got to be professional, it's either the two. Or we're definitely in this paradigm where people want this feel of being an anti-establishment figure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I totally understand where you're coming from, Pelliter. I think that for people who want someone who is anti-establishment and goes against, you know, the establishment, kind of have that rebellious mindset, makes it, it's a very rational decision to vote for Donald Trump because he definitely represents the anti-establishment figure. Now, not to say that all people who voted for Donald Trump had rational reasons. There were a number of people who were clearly misled when they voted for Donald Trump. For example, polls of Donald Trump's voters show that about over half think that the unemployment increased under Obama when it actually decreased significantly, and the stock market decreased under Obama when it actually increased significantly. So a number of people made irrational decisions, ones that weren't based on fact. But it sounds like you and a number of other people who share your perspective of just kind of wanting to shake up the establishment, definitely made a rational decision that aligns with their values and goals in voting for Donald Trump.
I noticed talking to different Trump supporters, some Trump supporters were attracted to him because of his persona, while others maybe agreed strongly with his position or a kind of reaction against political correctness. As far as political correctness goes, do you see that as a barrier to rationalism? And that, I mean, that was a major factor why Trump got elected, because mm-hmm. people were kind of fed up with being told what they can and cannot say. Do you see political correctness as a barrier to rationalism?
Yeah, there is certainly an aspect to it which is a barrier to rationalism, because it inhibits truth speaking in certain ways. People feel restrained on their ability to express their thoughts. So political correctness, I think, sometimes can definitely go too far. There is a difference between political correctness and political politeness, let's say it that way. So for example, I'll give you an example. I come from a Jewish background, right? So I think there are certain terms that it would be fine to call me, let's say, you know, I am Jewish. So it's, you know, fine to call me a Jew, although it doesn't represent a major part of my identity, but sure, it does a little bit. But it would not be fine, it wouldn't be polite to call me a kaik, which is kind of a pejorative term for a Jew, for listeners who might not know that term. You know, same goes for everyone, you know. It's fine to call somebody, let's say, a liberal, but it's not fine to call somebody a libtard. You know, that's an offensive pejorative term. That's where you want, I think that's a difference between political politeness and political correctness. You know, to have terms that are pejorative, you don't want to go there. To have terms that are normal and appropriate, it's fine to use that terminology. So restraining neutral terms, I think, is harmful. You know, I was talking, I was on a conservative radio talk show with somebody called Larry Stevenson, the black-bearded cowboy. He's very conservative. He was saying that he likes everything that Trump is doing, except that he hasn't yet locked Hillary up. So that tells you of how far right, you know, right wing he is. And he says, we had a really nice conversation about orienting toward the truth and fighting post-truth politics. So we had a good conversation. But what he and I were talking about, we were talking about political politeness and political correctness. And he said that he doesn't like it when people refer to him as African-American. He's black. He likes to use the term, you know, black American. That's what he is. So I think political correctness goes too far when it prevents people from saying things like, oh, hey, you're black. Sure, you're black. Okay, that's fine. You know, you don't need to use terms like African-American. But, you know, you don't want to use the N-word, which would go into the pejorative connotation, you know? So I think that's kind of where you need to draw the balance. That's my thoughts on this.
I think we live today, especially towards an era of identity politics, where there's certainly a lot of division in America between different races. And, you know, especially if Donald Trump now being a president, it's almost half the nation likes him as a president, and yet the other half want him out. Or at least some people in, like, liberal positions. But the thing is, it's totally divided our country. And instead of rational thinking, what has happened, I guess, is that people base things on their identity. I mean, I'm pretty sure you know of Milo Yiannopoulos, or I can never pronounce his last name. But
I think it's Yiannopoulos.
Yes. He was at a you know, he's doing his tour where he, you know, talks about political correctness and tries to relate to, you know, the social justice type, or at least the very insecure young people. And so, you know, he has these videos on his YouTube channel. Here are the anti-fascist protesters against Milo. One of the kid goes up to him and says, look, I am a bi Jewish kid that had an ex-black girlfriend, and I love Milo, and I voted for Trump, and you to say that I am not a part, or to say that I'm a fascist or a racist is completely absurd. You know, I am for what Milo says, and yet there's this strange tension where you really don't know what is happening anymore, or at least identities become an issue where it's totally emotion, right? It's hard to treat everyone securely as a special individual, and it's strange, right?
Yeah, I totally resonate with that, Peter. I think I sometimes see liberals saying things like, oh, you know, how can these white working class people vote against their interests? Or how can women vote for Trump? And I laugh at that sometimes, because you're presuming, sure, Trump is offensive toward women, but you're presuming that women have being female as their primary identity. They might not. That might not be the primary thing about them. To them, it might be more important to have a small government or to, you know, other identity issues that are more relevant to them than their gender and their sex. And for white working class voters, their economic status might not be as relevant to them. Sure, Trump is likely to be harmful for them economically, but they might resonate with his, let's say, message to make the United States militarily stronger. You know, he already signed an executive order to put more money into the military. Or they might resonate with his message to have less immigrants in the United States. That doesn't mean that they're voting against their interests, because their interests are not simply economic, and that might not be their primary thing. And women might not have their primary identity as being female, and that's okay. So I agree with you when you kind of presuming that one's visible identity is their primary identity is quite harmful and not really rational.
Where you are in Ohio, I mean, that is a state that has been economically devastated, and his message on trade has really resonated. What are your thoughts on the situation in Ohio from your observations living there?
Oh, absolutely. I think there are lots of people, especially in more rural and smaller towns in Ohio, who have bought into Donald Trump's message on trade and economics. And this message, again, kind of is illustrative of some people being simply mistaken about who has the right message. A number of people in Ohio, for example, believe that unemployment went up under Obama and the stock market went down, which are mistakes. I mean, that's not true. But so they have been misled by some of the stuff that Donald Trump was saying. But it does speak to a deep underlying concern with the economic situation, which Donald Trump was able to tap into very successfully. Even if what he said wasn't true, it was still spoke to the emotions of people and their economic concerns. We saw the same sort of messaging with Bernie Sanders when he really resonated with a lot of voters here in Ohio in a way that Hillary Clinton didn't, because they saw Hillary Clinton as representing more of kind of the Wall Street establishment. I mean, a lot of people are having voter regret now that Donald Trump is filling his cabinet with people from Goldman Sachs and so on, and ExxonMobil. Kind of, they didn't think that would happen. They thought that he would drain the swamp. But still, he was able to successfully, if not truthfully, resonate with the underlying emotional concerns of the voters, many of the voters here in Ohio who are concerned with that issue.
Pilliter, do you want to comment on the economic issues from your observations living in Pennsylvania, which is also a Rust Belt, a swing state that has traditionally leaned a Democrat and went for Trump?
Yep, it's actually a Trump state, and supposedly this might go with the whole decision-making too. I live outside of Philadelphia, and everybody, you see Trump signs everywhere. It was pretty much a little Trump nation wherever you go, but it was inside Philadelphia. It was pro-Hillary. Now, there was a controversy within the Philadelphia that there was major voter fraud, and that this voter fraud was particularly for Hillary, that they would have these, you only vote Hillary, and you couldn't vote even Trump, or that they changed the votes to get to Hillary. But otherwise, that, it's a pretty liberal city, Philadelphia, and they would mostly, majority would vote for Hillary. However, it seems like everything outside was definitely Trump. And there's been some shock around the Pennsylvania area. How could they possibly fall for Trump, even though it seemed, you know, Democrat for a very long time? Yet I think this has a lot to do with emotions on both sides. One, the Democrats would emotionally do voter fraud to vote for Hillary, and emotionally to everyone else that is not in line with some of the higher-up Democrats and the working-class Pennsylvania people would go and vote for Trump. So it's definitely an emotional thing that has happened in Pennsylvania that has led to Trump's victory.
You have a lot of millennials, and there is a sense of kind of hopelessness about the future and looking to someone, whether it's like a well, Bernie Sanders is more the popular candidate related to people with student debt issues.
For student debt, I think that's definitely something that resonated with students, but I think we shouldn't. It's often, again, it kind of goes back into people's economic interests. I think it's much more important that Bernie Sanders tapped into the underlying emotions of millennials around justice and fairness. So these are, by according to polls, these are emotions that millennials strongly resonate with. Justice and fairness and wanting to help other people, they tend to be more idealistic than other generations. They tend to care more and be more empathetic and altruistic, and they want these things. They want to express their compassion, and they want justice and fairness. And Bernie Sanders tapped into these things very effectively. I think it was really secondary what he was talking about, student debt. I think the emotions were much more powerful that he tapped into those. And that's why you saw so many people come out for Bernie Sanders as opposed to Hillary Clinton. And that's my thoughts, but I turn it over to Pilliter to share his perspective.
That's interesting you reference altruism, especially with the Bernie Sanders part. Have you gotten the chance to read the Pathological Altruism with the by Barbara Oakley? It was a book about that, making actions based upon, you know, doing good or being pathologically altruistic and making bad mistakes with it or bad choices.
I haven't read it. Can you share a little bit more about it?
Yeah, it came out in about, I think, 2012. It kind of had, when it was out, I remember it too. I remember being referenced in a psychology class I had, and the main thesis from it, from Barbara Oakley's book, was that people make strange decisions, or at least that there's an ingrained trait of pathological altruism, where people will often get high on their altruism trait and do things which they'll feel good, but they're making sometimes the wrong actions. Like, kind of like if you have a caring mom that always has to make your bed in the morning, but then she'll keep doing it even when, you know, the bed's already made, or at least it's unnecessary. That, and she, on the other hand, you know, being the would feel like the mom is caring for her kid, but is now like a victim of being altruistic. Now, you could also argue that that might be something to do with the cultural background of being Christian, or maybe something to do with cultural backgrounds. But it seems that the thesis of pathological altruism has been that altruism can be exploited, and people can be out of control. And this has something to do with you're talking about wise decision makings, and how do you you know, split between, you know, your emotions, if that's like 70 or 80% of what you're making through your emotions, depend an actual rational decision, which is not emotional.
Yeah, great question. Okay, thank you for clarifying. Yes, so I know the general idea of the harmful altruism, so thank you for sharing what it was about in the book. I think that's, you see a lot of that going on in a number of contexts, not simply in kind of making the bed, but often, let's say the United States or Western countries intervene in developing nations and think that they're doing a good thing by intervening there. And sometimes they're not. They're making a big mistake by intervening there to, you know, have, on behalf of some groups. And a prominent example is unveiling of Muslim women. So there is an idea in Western society that Muslim women are repressed because they wear the veil, the hijab. But many Muslim women do so voluntarily. Some don't, but some do wear the veil voluntarily. And it's a very problematic thing to try to unveil Muslim women and force them to not wear the veil as though you're doing something good and altruistic for them. So it's very important to figure out whether your altruistic action is serving a beneficial cause. So to do that, that's one. Now, it's also important to figure out whether you're doing the most effective thing in your altruism. For example, it might be generally good to get to train up a guiding dog for people who are blind, right? But that takes several thousand dollars to get a blind eye dog. It takes much less money, you know, something like dozens of dollars, to cure someone of blindness by helping them get cataract surgery in the developing world. And there are a number of organizations that do that. So if you really care about blindness, are you going to spend several thousand dollars on a guide dog, or are you going to spend like $20 on helping get someone cataract surgery? Both of those actions are altruistic, but one of those actions is much more altruistic than the other one because you're actually making much more of a difference. So a wise decision making from the perspective, if your goal is to address blindness, the wise thing to do from perspective of decision making is to invest into cataract eye surgery. And this is just an example. You can, you know, we can go much more in depth into this, but that's an example of decision making and effective decision making in the altruist sphere.
There's a general perception that rationalists tend to be libertarians, individualists tend to be secular. Is rationalism compatible with multiple different political ideologies? Give some examples of, say, economic leftism like socialism, social conservatism, or nationalism? Or would you say rationalism is tied towards individualism and libertarianism and secularism?
Sure, great question. So rationalism in itself is not value-based. Oh, it's about pursuing one's goals in the most effective manner and orienting toward the truth. So it would be discordant with ideologies that are not oriented toward pursuing the truth. In some cases, that involves... So there is some natural inherent discord with religion. That is correct. Because religion takes faith as its basis. So faith basically says, like, you know, you need to believe this thing, which is something that would not align with what we experience with our senses. You know, Jesus Christ rising from the dead, burning bush appearing, reincarnation, all of this stuff is not in accordance with our senses. Now, so there is some discord between religion and rationality. That doesn't mean that religious people can't be rational. So I mentioned that can't be rationalists. I mentioned that I run the organization Intentional Insights, kind of promoting rational thinking. One of our core participants is a United Methodist minister, Caleb Pitkin. And he writes for us, he writes about rationality in a religious context and how he aims to be religious in a rational context. He acknowledges that he is not fully rational and he's okay with that. He takes as faith that God exists, that kind of the United Methodist principles are appropriate and correct, and he acknowledges this. But then he goes on to say that, well, in other areas of his life, he's rational. And within his religious belief, within those basic concepts, he aims toward rationality. So one doesn't have to fully buy into rationalism, into rational thinking, to aspire toward greater rationality. So that's kind of one aspect of the answer. So yes, there is some discordance, but one doesn't have to be that. In the same way, you asked about nationalism. Nationalism presumes that one's country, one's people are better than others, inherent, for no specific reason. So
well,
there's that,
again, nationalism, like exceptionalism, like American exceptionalism, saying that America is the best country, far superior to others. Then there's like nationalism in the sense of just national sovereignty.
Yes, so I'm talking about the first one. There's a difference between patriotism, which is kind of just love for one's country, that's kind of value-based, And there's difference between respect for national sovereignty, which that's different. Nationalism, kind of the traditional definition of nationalism, is the idea that one's country is inherently better than others. And that, again, there's no factual basis for this based on one's experiences, sensory experiences. You know, if you objectively compare one's country to others, there's no necessary reason why an American is better than someone who's British, than better than someone who's from South Africa, better than someone who's from Thailand, better than someone who's from China. There's no reason for that. So you can't just go and say, oh, okay, well, according to rationality, you can't go and say, you know, oh, you know, nationalism is, you know, America is better than everyone else, having this idea of exceptionalism. So there is some discordance there. There is also some discordance between racism and rationality, because again, that's predicated on the idea that a certain race is better than another race. And again, there's very little evidence that certain races are better than others. Now, you have some genetic evidence, for example, for certain races being different. For example, Africans, people who come from Africa, tend to be much more genetically diverse than other people. So they tend to be both the shortest people and the tallest people, the strongest people and the weakest people, the smartest people and the least smart people, so on. Just because of genetic diversity, most of humanity issued from Africa, and therefore only a small component of genetic diversity, the tribes that issued out of Africa, are present outside of Africa. So you'll have more genetic diversity, but that doesn't speak to anything about a better of races or not.
There's sort of racism in the concept of saying your group is better than others, and what about just sort of people feeling more comfortable with people who share common interests, or people feeling more comfortable with the same, like, just kind of like tribalism?
Sure. Tribalism is not racism. It's a factual statement. A feeling of comfort is a very rational thing because it talks about your emotions. You know, I would feel, we talked about Jewish background, right? I would feel more comfortable with someone as a baseline level, not knowing anything about anyone else. I would feel more comfortable with someone who is from a Jewish background than someone who's not, just because that person has certain cultural traditions and certain identity, certain things about Jewishness. You know, they know what Passover is. They know about, you know, the Holocaust. They have certain emotional resonances that I share as well. So sure, I'd feel more comfortable with them. Now, is that irrational? No, that's talking about my emotions. Now, if I speak of something like being Jewish is inherently better than being something else, that speaks to a judgment, a value judgment that's not based on reality. That's not based on sensory experiences of what is real or not. Because, you know, on what metric am I comparing better or not? So that would be, again, racism. It would not be accordant with rationality.
It's a very interesting talk. I was just, it's, because when I was reading about, thinking about wise decision-making, I feel as if that I'm never so sure or in control of my own rational thinking, right? Maybe I might be buying a new pair of shoes or new clothes because I feel like it and it's pretty and I buy it, and then all of a sudden the emotion goes away. And then, like in a consuming market, I know they probably do this with like clothes stores all the time, then you want more. It's, you get excited with buying the product and having it, and then that charm feeling goes away within like 3 or 4 days. Right, compared to a longevity thing, that if you own a possession of something, it might benefit you, right? Like if you have like a grand piano and you learn piano every day, but you might buy a grand piano and just enjoy having it as a furniture piece and do absolutely nothing. And so I feel like maybe, I don't know what I'm getting from this whole wise decision making coaching. I mean, if people are to really make wise decision making, would that have some kind of placebo or drug effect against their will, or is there a certain knowledge that someone should know prior or to strive to making decision-making? Because I know you're also a consultant or a coaching to make people lead to make the best decisions.
Sure, good question, Peter. Yes, so that's an aspect of what I do. I do coaching and consulting for companies and leaders and individuals who have sufficient money to hire me, to so executive leaders mostly, but again, kind of also prominent figures of various sorts, on making wise decisions. And it really doesn't need anything. You don't need to know anything prior to doing so, but you need to be willing to recognize that your emotions are not always going to lead you to your goals. So I talked about the person who wants to punch out his boss because they criticized him. And that is a very fundamental and basic emotion that really doesn't lead us toward our goals. I'll give you another example. So right now I'm working with an engineering consulting company. It has something like 200 employees, 150 of them are engineers. It works in hard engineering, so kind of welding and so on. Now, these engineers care about problem solving. They like problem solving. They like their quote-unquote nerdy things, and they don't like to do marketing or customer relations. But because it's a consulting firm, they need to do marketing and customer relations, customer service, in order for the company to make money and to make sales. So the company has not been doing so well because the engineers are essentially paid per hour, and they would choose, they would prefer to spend their hours on doing the sort of, you know, their nerdy technical problems rather than customer relations. So I went into the company and I helped them change the incentive structure, the incentive systems, to incentivize engineers to care about customer service and to care about marketing by helping engineers understand that by doing more marketing and more customer relations, they will be doing more of the things that they actually care about, which is their nerdy things. So, for example, I got them to talk to engineers not about branding themselves. They were using brand and marketing talk to get engineers to do marketing. I talked to engineers about being thought leaders, about getting an opportunity to talk more about the nerdy things that they care about, their technical problem-solving stuff, with other people like them, and getting them excited about it, speaking to their emotions in their language, what they care about, and also getting their peers, other engineers like them, to do peer reviews of engineers. So, and there's a lot of research showing that people like engineers care a lot about what other engineers think about them. So being peer-reviewed by your fellow engineers and having your salary tied to that is a much more effective way of incentivizing engineers to care about what you actually need them to do. So it's kind of being emotionally intelligent and using wise decision-making about compensation in order to get the company moving forward. That's one. Another one, so I have been coaching, executive coaching for a leader of a major nonprofit, and one thing that he was having trouble with is interacting with his board of directors. His board of directors was kind of pressuring him and putting pressure on him to do fundraising, and he really wasn't feeling it, and he was getting burned out. So I got him to talk to his board about his emotions. Previously, he didn't think that his emotions were something that he could bring up to the board. It's like, oh, no, we need to just be rational and talk about, like, what's formal stuff. And but really, our emotions shape so much of our decision-making. And if he's not excited about doing fundraising, then he will not be able to do it successfully. So I got him to talk to them about it, got him to talk to about his emotions and their emotions, and that will, they had a much more successful and productive collaboration going forward. They were able to provide him with appropriate support for him to do the things that he actually needed to do. So that's kind of an example of consulting for a company, and then executive coaching that I do to help people make wise decisions that consider their emotions and the emotions of others.
There's are people who are more conformist and people who are more nonconformist, and different psychological types. So there's different extremes. Some people are extreme conformist, and they'll just do whatever people's are around them are doing to get by in society or to get status. And then some people are extreme nonconformist who go out of their way to kind of isolate. I wouldn't say, well, not isolate themselves, but just set themselves apart from other people and the dominant culture. How does conformity and nonconformity relate to people's political decisions?
Political decisions. I'd say that well, something that Phil Eater talked about earlier, and you can comment more on this, is that younger people especially tend to be nonconformist. That's just a part of growing up and kind of freeing yourself from the influence of your parents. So they tend to want to shake up the world more and be more idealistic. When people grow up, they tend to get more settled in and be less comfortable with shaking things up and making changes. That's one thing. So it's age-related. Another thing is kind of personality-related. People who are inherently oriented toward the truth and skeptical tend to be more skeptical about traditional norms and traditional rules and traditional customs. They tend to be less conformist because they're skeptical and they are more oriented toward checking out the information behind what they're told by their elders and so on. Whereas people who are less oriented toward the truth, people who are more oriented tend to be less skeptical and more conformist and just going along with the flow because they don't want to shake up the boat, and they tend to care more about other people's feelings and social pressure and conform to these. So these are kind of, that's a very broad brush answer to the question.
What are your thoughts on the Myers-Briggs personality types? I think what I got is like on the border of INTP and INTF.
Sure. So Myers-Briggs personality types have been shown by research to be quite not valid. So the only part of Myers-Briggs that's valid is the introvert-extrovert aspect. And let me be clear. So for listeners who might not know, Myers-Briggs is a common personality type indicator. It was created and promulgated by Myers-Briggs and, anyway, people with that last name. It's been widely used because it's simple and convenient, but honestly, it's just not nearly, it has not been proven to be consistent. So people who take it at one time and then take it a few weeks later get totally different scores, except on the introvert-extrovert scale, which is something that has been research-based. So the other stuff except the introvert-extrovert scale, I would not trust, and it's really problematic. For people who want to look at their personality, another prominent personality scale that's been actually research-based is the Big Five personality scale. So that has been shown to be consistent by research. I would strongly recommend that folks use that. And again, you know, this is just coming from the research aspect of it. Orienting toward science or orienting toward research, that's the one that's been shown to be consistent.
You've talked about the concept of emotional intelligence. What is the significance of emotional intelligence? How would you define emotional intelligence as different than just generic intelligence or intellectual intelligence, or say someone who's like good at math? Mm-hmm. And you've also written about how emotional intelligence can help people address speech and anxiety. Is emotional intelligence a trait, or is that something people, a personality trait, or that's something people can strive to improve on?
Sure. So emotional intelligence is a combination of various skills, and it involves being self-aware around one's emotions. So what one is feeling right now. And as we mentioned, emotions make up the majority of our decision-making. So it's really very useful to know when to not punch out our boss. So, or, you know, who to vote for or any other sort of decision-making. Or what Bill Eater was talking about, when to buy things and what things to buy and why you're buying it, right? Kind of consumerism. So knowing why you're doing things, knowing your emotions, very important. Then managing your emotions. So being able to direct your emotions, not simply being aware that you have a desire to punch out your boss, but then not punching out your boss, or not being, you know, not voting with your gut, just, you know, even though you have a desire to vote with your gut, not buying, you know, the $1,000 piece, you know, I don't know, $1,000 piece of jewelry or, you know, ring for your beloved when a silver thing of like, you know, $50 will do just as well, something like that. So making a decision that's really in accordance with your goals. So managing, knowing your emotions and managing your emotions is the fundamentals of emotional intelligence. There's a separate thing And another, the third aspect of emotional intelligence that's also important is empathy, knowing what other people are feeling. So knowing what other people are feeling, that involves another subset of skills that has to do with figuring out what are the emotions of others, modeling them correctly. So is the other person, are they lying to you or not? Are they feeling bored when you're talking to them? Are you able to convey your message to them? What kind of signs are there on their face, in their body gesture, in their tone, and so on? So that's those are the three broad areas of emotional intelligence. Each of those areas has a number of subsets of skills, which we can talk about. Now, there's another aspect that's been more recently written about, which is social intelligence. Social intelligence has to do with not simply knowing, being empathetic about the emotions of others, but being able to influence their emotions. So when I talked about and being able to structure their emotions, when I talked about how do you engage with the engineers in the consulting firm, that's an example of social intelligence, being able to influence the emotions of others and figure out policies that influence their emotions and structure them in the direction that you want them to go. Or when I talked about the nonprofit leader who talked to his board and got them to shift their emotions and kind of the engagement there, that's social intelligence, kind of being able to shift and engage with the emotions of others to reach your goals. So that relates to emotional intelligence. This question about speech making is, you know, that is basically about, it's really very tied to emotional intelligence because we need to be aware that, well, why a lot of people are afraid of making speeches, and that fear is obviously an emotion. So you need to be aware of one, your fears in making speeches. You need to be able to manage your fears. Then you need to be able to read the crowd. So read the emotions of the crowd. When you're making your speech, are people bored? Are people disengaged? Or are they engaged and excited? You need to be able to take them through a narrative, an emotional narrative, to get them engaged. And then you need to be able to manage their emotions. So you need to be charismatic and so on. That has to do with social intelligence. Projecting their emotion, the emotions to them that you want them to have, and then getting them to do what you want them to do as a result of the speech, which is like the whole point of a speech. Do you want them to learn something? Do you want them to take an action? Do you want them to buy stuff from you? Do you want them to vote in a certain way or something like that? Whatever you want them to do. So that's kind of how you apply them to speeches. Does that answer the question, Robert?
Yes. And what do you think about the whole concept of a sociopathy? So there's sort of a perception that a sociopath is someone who lacks compassion or empathy towards others. Mm-hmm. There's also, I've also heard about studies that sociopaths are, because they lack that anxiety about caring what other people think, they're disproportionately overrepresented in positions of power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think here we need to be careful about our terms. So empathy has to do with understanding what others feel.
So you can have empathy for someone and understand where they're coming from, but at the same time, you can still hate that person.
Absolutely. So there's a difference between compassion and empathy. Empathy is understanding other people. Compassion is caring for other people. So, for example, Hitler was a very empathetic person, very empathetic. He really could read crowds very well, like really well. Now, he was also... I doubt that he cared much about what Jews felt. Let's say it that way. So in the same way, Donald Trump is highly empathetic. He's very good at empathy. He knows what crowds feel. He can write, he can play with crowds. He can get people to feel various things. He can read them very well. He doesn't care that much about what people who are not in his in-tribe feel, who he doesn't care about. So he's not very compassionate. Now, there's a lot of research showing that psychopaths can be on both. They can have, psychopaths have, the definition of psychopathy is people with who lack compassion. Now, people who lack that term, that's just kind of the definition of psychopathy. And most people are compassionate to some extent. when people don't have, for genetic reasons usually, they don't have that compassion. It can sometimes be for memetic reasons, for the way you're brought up, kind of the experiences that happen to you. But for people who don't have that compassion, that's psychopathy.
One theory I've actually heard is that in the past, if someone didn't care, well, people were dependent on other people, so if they were too sociopathic, they would be wiped out of the gene pool. But I've also heard theories that like sociopathic genes have been on the rise because how modern society has changed. Because in the past, they would have either been killed off or they would have people had to like depend on others in a tribal setting for survival.
Yeah, sociopathy is probably on the rise. I haven't read too much about it, but I think it's always been there because we can't have a society that's majorly sociopathic. Otherwise, our whole society would die. But it's for sociopaths, it's they can rise to power in society because they don't care about others. So, for example, a lot of people who are interrogators or torturers, that's a really good position to be a sociopath, like prison guards. Well, prison guards don't need to be interrogators or torturers. They need to be able to understand their subject, who they're speaking to, in order to get information from them, to build rapport, to understand their emotions, but not care about them. Similarly, marketers and salespeople have to be really good at understanding people, but they also have to not care that they're screwing people over. You know, tobacco salespeople, let's say, to know that they're giving essentially cancer sticks to people and getting them to have cancer, but be really at the same time highly empathetic and understand how to get people to buy cancer sticks. So similarly with leaders, leaders are often, as you mentioned correctly, on the psychopathic scale, high on the psychopathic scale, because it's beneficial to really read people well and be highly empathetic, but not be compassionate. You know, you would also have some leaders who are not that. For example, Hillary Clinton, she is highly compassionate, clearly, but she's not very empathetic. She doesn't read crowds well. She's not very relatable, not very charismatic. But she's quite compassionate from, you know, her caring about children and so on and so forth. So whereas Bill Clinton would be another example of a person who is compassionate and empathetic. So he takes a lot of effort to care for people, but he also reads crowds very well and is able to engage with people really highly well. So those are some examples of people who are, you know, different on the who are leaders with those traits. And again, Hitler would be a person who is clearly not very compassionate, but clearly highly empathetic and charismatic. You know, I'd say Trump is also. I can't psychoanalyze Trump, so I don't. You know, not insufficient information, but he's clearly very empathetic in terms of reading crowds very well, and highly not compassionate. I'm not sure if he would fall into the psychopathy scale, but he would definitely be someone who's not very compassionate and someone who's very empathetic.
You've written about collaborative truth-seeking as in debates. As far as debates go, there's general a concept of a debate as a conflict. You write about a debate as people putting ideas out there and a debate in a constructive sense of coming to the conclusion of the truth as opposed to a debate as a conflict.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. So we often, when we think about debates, the term debate, we think of argument and war. So, you know, there's often the idea that arguments are soldiers. I crush my opponent. I defeat my opponent in a debate. I undermine his argument and so on. I fortify my argument, my defenses and so on against that opponent. So when we get into debate mode, we think of winning. We don't think of seeking the truth. So if we actually want to have a conversation that's focused on the truth around contentious issues, it's much better to think in a different mode than debates, to think of collaborative truth seeking. So just and that's a separate, that's a reframing strategy. So we reframe our thinking toward orienting toward truth seeking. So
but
orient
also
toward truth seeking.
Someone could be have bad ideas, but have really good debating skills and vice versa.
Absolutely. debate has been, evolutionary psychology shows that debate has not risen for us to find truth. It has risen as a result of various tribal social warfare, kind of warfare with words, for various groups to win in society and various individuals. So it's not oriented toward finding the truth. Now, if you want to win, that's great to debate. If you want to find the truth, that's not what you should go for. Collaborative truth-seeking is a much better strategy, again, for contentious issues, to find the truth. That involves first establishing trust, establishing shared goals of orienting toward truth, showing empathy as well as compassion toward each other, encouraging each other to update beliefs, celebrating each other for acknowledging that one's points are, you know, weak and so on. And when someone undermines one of your points, to say, okay, you know, that's a point I give up, let's go back to the other points. And for the other person to say, yes, good job for giving up that point, let's talk about other points. That creates a culture, a mutual culture, and a shared trust of empathy and compassion toward each other. And then slow through that sort of interaction, one that's collaborative and seeks the truth, both people are oriented toward figuring out what is true. And it's important at the start to acknowledge that, look, it's likely that neither of us have the perfect truth. We will likely end up meeting somewhere in the middle. Maybe not. Maybe one of us is perfectly correct. But having that humble attitude is really important for establishing trust and a shared sense of rapport.
Gleb Sapirsky, it's been an excellent show. I would like to thank you for being on.
Thank you so much, Robert. It's been a pleasure to talk to you and Peliter.
This is awesome. Thanks for talking.